Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Cure Talks. This is Priya Menon joining you from India. And today we are talking about multiple myeloma. The patient panel is led by Gary Peterson, myeloma survivor and editor of myelomasurvival.com. And he is today's co-host. Joining Gary on the panel are survivors and advocates Jack Aiello, Cynthia Chmielewski, and Yelak Biro. The featured expert on the talk today is Dr. William Matsui, hematologist-oncologist at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Welcome to Cure Talks, everyone. It's a pleasure to have you all with us once again. As we know, multiple myeloma remains incurable despite improved remissions with novel agents. Relapse eventually occurs in the form of drug-resistant disease that carries a dismal prognosis. Relapse is dependent on stem cell functions. We are talking to Dr. Matsui to get a better understanding of the drivers of these functions and how they may lead to novel therapies for relapsed disease. We will be taking questions towards the end of the discussion. And if you have a question for Dr. Matsui, please email them to priya@trialx.com or post on Cure Talks website. You can also press 1 on your telephone keypad and we will bring you on air to ask your questions. With that, I will now hand over to Gary Peterson to begin with the discussion. Gary, it's over to you.
Well, I thank you, Priya, and thank you so much for bringing this forum for all of us who are myeloma patients to better understand this disease and what we need in order to survive it. So with that, I would like to introduce Dr. Matsui. And what I'll do is I'll give the Cliff Notes version because we have quite an extensive number of questions. But Dr. William Matsui is a professor of oncology at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine within the Division of Hematologic Malignancies. He directs the Multiple Myeloma Program at the Johns Hopkins Kimmel Cancer Center. And I think the next sentence says pretty much a significant amount about what, A, we're going to talk about today and also what his focus is. And his primary focus is the research to better understand the role of cancer stem cells and hematologic malignancies and develop novel therapeutic strategies to target these cells. So welcome, Dr. Matsui, again to Cure Talks.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
I'd say the rest of it, but it would take the entire hour, so we got a lot more to talk about because you do have an extensive background. But brought you back because I think it was 2016 when we talked last on this program, and earlier than that, I think, with Jenny on another program, Jenny Ahlstrom. But back then, you were kind of the lone stranger as far as the CAR T, but and stem cells. But now, pretty much, CAR T has taken center stage, and you are now, in the limelight, and all things. And Doctor, we were talking to Dr. June about CAR T, the CAR T program, a few weeks ago, and he explained that although CD19 is not present on myeloma cells, CD19 CAR T cells work in 20% of the patients. And he was. Followed by highlighting that your work at Johns Hopkins on myeloma stem cells is one of the reasons that perhaps this has been as successful as it has been. So with that, I was wondering if you might be able to talk to our patients who are listening who would like to learn a little bit about what the stem cell is and how it differs from the normal cells, and specifically myeloma. And also, maybe if you could clear something up for me, because I'm a little confused, because I thought stem cells were something that created, if you want to call it that, you know, white and red blood cells plus B cells. And in your analysis, I had read that you had separated B cells from the, from the myeloma cells, and myeloma cells won't reproduce themselves, but in the B cells, if introduced in rats or whatever, will in fact result in myeloma. So, are myeloma cells then B cells, or you know, is there a way to differentiate a stem cell from a myeloma stem cell, or how do you do that? And I as a result, you know, it's kind of, if it's a B cell, is a B cell a stem cell? So that's what was my confusion. So if you can,
sure,
as you go through this, clear that up for me.
Sure. So I think that there are, you know, a couple of disclaimers. I think one is that I've not really been a part of the CAR T cell story. I think that that's really been championed by many groups, mostly, you know, most prominently, I think, Dr. June's group. And I think he's been very kind to highlight our work in terms of what they've done. For us, it's really, you know, when I started out as, let's say, when I was in medical school and then when I was training, the one thing that always puzzled me was, why do patients relapse, right? Like, you can take cancers, many cancers, not exclusively myeloma, but treat them until they're just about, you can't find them, see any evidence or any trace of them, and yet there's some diseases where in just about every patient, unfortunately, the disease is going to come back. And myeloma is one of those diseases to a great extent. There are other leukemias and lymphomas that have the same sorts of patterns. And so for me, you know, when I started out, the whole question was, is that what is the problems, or what are the processes that are going on that are leading to cancers returning? Because I thought in a very simple way that if you can prevent them from coming back, then essentially you can make people live longer and potentially cure them, right? Because that's really, curing them is not having them come back. So the way that we addressed this was trying to figure out, are all myeloma cells the same? Are they all the same? Do they all sort of have the same properties and the same potential for growth? And, you know, you brought up a great point, which is this idea of stem cells. And, you know, one, I think, example of how cells are all not the same is in the bone marrow. So you have different types of cells. You have stem cells, and then you have more mature cells. And those mature cells actually really do the job that they're supposed to do, right? They protect you from infections in the case of white cells. They carry around oxygen in the case of red cells. And so those mature cells have a job to do, but one of their jobs is not to make more of themselves. So in the bone marrow, it's really a stem cell, a hematopoietic stem cell, that gives rise to all of those other cells. But that stem cell, if you just had those stem cells, you would still be susceptible to infections, you'd still be anemic, because those cells can't do those jobs. And so there's a compartmentalization of different functions that different cells can do. So in stem cell biology, stem cells have a bunch of different attributes. And so in the case of hematopoietic stem cells, I think is a great example. So one of their jobs is to make all of the other cells and to, you know, give rise to daughter cells that become all these mature cells. The other job that they have is to actually stay around, right? Because if you don't have enough stem cells, then at some point you're not making blood, and that is not a good thing. So in us as humans, if we think about the normal bone marrow, bone marrow stem cells, we probably have about 100,000 of those cells, and those cells end up having to make about 90 billion cells a day to replace all of the red cells and white cells that we lose. So there's an incredible expansion along the way, but one of the most important things is that you're making blood your entire life, and so you must have some stem cells that are around for your entire life. So if you think about it, if you think about it in those terms, one aspect is, for sure, stem cells being able to give rise to other cells that are maturing. And then the second, though, is that they need to hang around forever, right? Because if they don't, then you can't make new cells, and then that becomes a problem. So when we talk about cancer stem cells or stem cells in cancer, I think that it's not necessary that we have to ascribe all of the properties to those cells. And so I think that in the case of cancers, well, we do care about what kind of cells they make, because that might lead to specific medical problems. But I think that in terms of thinking about relapse, what we care about is that are there cells that are able to give rise to new cells, and how long can they do that for? Because if they can do that, you know, longer than you're alive, then you're never going to be cured, right? So one part of the thought about stem cells, and especially in cancer, is really focusing on this one property called self-renewal, which allows stem cells to be maintained over time. So there's always a pool of cells to grow new tumor cells. And so in myeloma, it ends up being that the stem cells are not the same thing as hematopoietic stem cells. They're actually more like B cells. And I think you asked a great question, which is like, how can B cells be stem cells? Well, B cells give rise to, you know, a mature population of cells. Those are plasma cells. And then the other thing is that B cells and also T cells have this very unique property in that they are actually able to last for a long, 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 long time in your body. And part of that is that if you think about it, they're there to provide immunity against certain things. And so if we vaccinate someone against polio when they're an infant, you know, immune protection actually lasts almost just about the entire lifespan of that individual. So if, you know, one great example is that there was a study done about 10 years ago where there was a lot of concern about bioterrorism, and one of the pathogens was smallpox, and nobody gets, you know, immunized against smallpox anymore. If you're of a certain age, you got immunized, but smallpox has been eradicated. So there's no reason why you need to maintain immunity to smallpox, because you never see it. But in those patients who were immunized years and years and years ago, if you look now, you still have immunity to smallpox, right? That has lasted forever. And so I think one of the thoughts about why is myeloma such a difficult thing to cure and to prevent it from coming back is that if B cells are involved, and B cells normally are going to last forever to provide you with immunity, then it makes sense that the cancerous counterpart of that is going to last forever as well. Like, that's its job. It's not gotten some magical property. It's just doing the normal job that it's supposed to do. So in terms of stem cells and myeloma, I think that it has been an incredibly controversial field. And I think that I've always realized this. I've never really understood what the major issues have actually been, why people are so opposed to this idea. But I think that part of it is the distinction between what do the cells look like and what can they do. So for me, what I wanted to figure out are the plasma cells the things that are maintaining, you know, that growth potential over a long period of time, or is it something else? Is it B cells? And that was the first experiment that you described, where we took patient samples and either took B cells or plasma cells. The plasma cells couldn't form tumors in mice, but the B cells could in our hands. And, you know, I think that I think it hit a nerve with a lot of people in the field, because most people spend their time, if they're doing research, studying plasma cells. And if you go up to someone and say, look, it's great that you're studying that because that's the tumor cell, that's truly the cell that's causing people to have bone problems, renal problems, problems with anemia, but those are not really the things that are responsible for the patient relapsing. You know, people have a contention with that because you're implying that they're studying sort of the wrong thing. I think that over time, you know, one of the things is, so there's this big distinction.
The world is flat.
Yes. So the big distinction is, and what people I think have a problem with, is the way that cells look, right? So if it does it look like a B cell or does it look like a plasma cell, and what can it do, right? And so one analogy I think that's a good one is that, you know, I'm in Baltimore, and Baltimore has a football team. It's the Ravens. And if you go to, you know, a game at the stadium on Sunday, right, and you said to someone who didn't know anything, you said, well, tell me who the football players are, right? And you can tell who the football players are because they're all wearing jerseys, right? If you go to the stadium on Sunday, every single person is wearing a jersey, right? But they're not all necessarily football players. And so part of the issue is that, can we completely link what a cell looks like to what it can actually do? And in our original work, we thought that B cells were very important. And in some patients, we think that that's still important. That may be the 20% of patients who are actually benefited by targeting CD19 with CAR T cells. But what we found over the last couple of years is that not in every single myeloma patients are the B cells the important cells, because this property of being able to survive for a long time and produce mature cells or more tumor cells over time, that can also be plasma cells as well. It depends on a number of things. It depends on where you are in your therapy. Like if you're in MGUS, I think that it's more important. B cells are more important. I think that if you have, unfortunately, something like plasma cell leukemia, I think that plasma cells actually have that property. I think that it depends on a lot of times on what your genetics are. So there are a lot of variables that dictate what the cell exactly that we're trying to target might be. And what I tell people is that don't get so hung up on whether it's a B cell or a plasma cell. What we should try to figure out is what are the biological properties, or what are the processes that allow cells, whether they're B cells or myeloma cells, to just maintain themselves over time. Because if we can target those things, then maybe what we can do is inhibit those pathways or processes, and maybe what we can do is prevent relapse from happening. So I think it's really important when, you know, to think about stem cells as a function and not as what do they look like. Because it's the function that kills you and brings the disease back. It's not actually what they look like, right? And so that is one of the messages we've been trying to get across for the last few years, is to be a little bit careful about what they look like, what they do. In terms of CAR T cells, you have to be actually pretty precise about what they look like, because you're targeting a specific protein on the surface of cells. And like I said, I think that in some cells, some patients, CD19 is important, and then in other patients, maybe something like BCMA may be more important. So I think that what we're trying to do is figure out a way of figuring out in an individual person what exactly is the cell that is causing extended growth. What does that cell look like, and can we target it with CD19? Can we target it with BCMA? Can we target it with NY-ESO? Can we figure out for an individual patient and personalize it to figure out what exact either CAR or antibody or other approach might be best for them?
So, you know, I guess one of the questions then would also be is, Are you suggesting that you really can't, you know, you can see, I believe, stem cells, right? You know what a stem cell is. You can take a look at it. But you can't see, or you haven't been able to differentiate myeloma stem cell?
So what we can do is we can tell, like, if you said, look, I have this tube of cells, do they have stem cell properties? Right, no matter what they look like, I could tell you
okay.
that because we have assays to do that. So that's a functional assay. If you said, in this particular person, they have B cells that are related to their myeloma and they have plasma cells related to their myeloma, which one of those cells is responsible for the patient relapsing, I would say, you know, it could actually be either one,
mm-hmm.
and I think that we could tease that out, but we would have to do one of these tests where we said, look, let's just take the different cells, grow them up in different, you know, environments
mm-hmm.
and see which one does it, because that's the one we should target. But like I said, at this point in time, I try to steer people a little bit away from, you know, what exactly is a cell? What does it look like? Is it a B cell? Is it a plasma cell? I think that it's more important to say, look, you know, what are the things that are allowing it to hang around forever? Because that's what we should be targeting. Not what it looks like, but what it actually does.
Okay. One last point, then, and I'll turn it over to the rest of the folks, is that, you know, if it, you're talking about function, so, but I think originally you had talked about stem cells as something that it wasn't a function necessarily. It was an actual cell that you were kind of
right.
looking at. And my question would have been then is, you know, if you in fact take your stem cells out when you get a transplant and then reintroduce them, are you also reintroducing, you know, these myeloma stem cells, if they are such a thing?
Like, I think that there's a potential for that, but it may be dependent upon, you know, the actual nature of the cell to some extent. I think that there've been a couple of studies during transplantation. So during autologous transplantation, one set of studies, and this experiment's been done multiple times, is that once you get a stem cell graft, what you do is you try to enrich for the hematopoietic stem cells. And you do that using usually like an antibody and a magnet and things like that. What you can do by that is collect those stem cells, and then all of the other cells will get purged. You won't collect those, right? So what you're giving back in a product then is really just pure hematopoietic stem cells. So if you do that experiment, if you do that versus just giving an unmanipulated graft, you just collect the graft from the peripheral blood and you don't collect it, you don't enrich for any stem cells, any hematopoietic stem cells, that actually you would think that since you're not introducing back any tumor cells, that the patient should do a lot better, right? But it ends up being that the patients do exactly the same as if they got just a plain old graft, where they just collected it and then just gave it back. And what that suggests to me is that basically it's not as important, it may not be as important if you're reinfusing myeloma stem cells back. It's probably that the myeloma stem cells are not eradicated by the melphalan that you're giving people, right? So I think that, you know, during a transplant, I think the major reason why people potentially relapse is probably not because you're putting bad stem cells back in. It's probably because there's stem cells in the patient and you're not able to actually get rid of them using high-dose chemotherapy.
Okay. And so I guess the next question is, or the second half of that is, are we targeting the wrong, you know, the wrong things? You know,
so I think that there's...
If we identify this...
right.
You know, these characters, you know, that we can just look at them and say, well, they express CD19, they express BCMA, they express this, and so we'll target that, and if you take care of those stem cells, then you take care of the disease.
I think that that is I would hope that that's the case. That's what I believe, and that's why, you know, we do what we do. I think that the, you know, if you were to say, well, you know, why, you know, if we think about how we develop medications for specific cancers, right? So when we first give someone, let's say we've, you know, discovered some chemical, and we say we think that it's going to work against cancer. So the first study that one, clinical trial that one would do is to give it to patients and for sure, number one, show that it's safe, right? But then the second thing we do is we try to see whether or not you can take patients with active cancer and make some of that go away, right? So when you do that and you do things like look at the M protein or your light chains or even if you go into the bone marrow and look for plasma cells, those are all the mature cells, right? Those are not potentially the stem cells. And so if it ends up being that, like in our calculations, it ends up being that a myeloma stem cell is probably, for every myeloma stem cell, there's probably 100,000 to a million plasma cells or mature cells. So if you, even if you get rid of everything and it looks like everything is gone, you can still have stem cells there that you don't detect. If you're developing drugs, you're really looking for chemicals or medicines that actually make the plasma cells go away. And if the stem cells are different than the plasma cells, then those drugs might not target the stem cells, right? And the other is that if you actually had a drug that targeted the stem cells and you gave it to someone and 100,000th of the tumor went away, you would never, ever be able to detect that right away, right? Your M protein would be the same. Your plasma cells would be the same. Your light chains would be the same. It would only be after a reasonable amount of time because you're not making any more tumor cells that you might now start to see those numbers get better. So I think that it's great to where we've gotten in myeloma. And I think that it's amazing how far the field has come. There's a ton of new medications. There's always new medications coming out. And it truly has helped patients with myeloma. Like, I run the myeloma program here. I have a lot of myeloma patients. And the drugs, for sure, are a true advance from what we used to do 15, 20 years ago. But at the same time, I think that it is, you know, potentially, are we targeting the right things or not? You know, I would say is if we're not able to cure the disease, then I think that potential exists. And that is sort of, I think, you know, been, like I said, I'm more than happy and interested in, like, how can you develop drugs to make plasma cells go away? But at the same time, if you do that and patients relapse, then I don't know how much more bang for the buck we're going to get by continuing to do that.
Yeah, well, so that's why your work is so very, very important. Jack, do you have some questions for the doctor?
I do. Thanks, Gary. And thank you, Dr. Masuli, for part of this call.
Sure.
We as patients always hear about how important the bone marrow microenvironment is surrounding the myeloma tumor cells, the plasma cells. Is that also the case? Is the bone marrow microenvironment important surrounding myeloma stem cells?
Yeah, so I think that it is very important. So if you think about any stem cells, like I provided the example of hematopoietic stem cells, there's 100,000 you have for your entire life. They have to make 90 billion blood cells a day, right? So that process of how much they make and what they make has to be incredibly tightly controlled, right? If you make even 1% more, you're going to have leukemia. If you make 1% less, you're not going to have enough blood cells, right? So it's really a finely tuned system. So stem cells are actually really, really good at listening and sensing their environment. So stem cells are really highly regulated by environmental cues. So there are cues in the, you know, in the bone marrow, let's say for hematopoietic stem cells, that tell them you got to make more neutrophils or you got to make more red blood cells. Like, those are all cues that are given by the environment, right? So in every tissue, the stem cells in every tissue, your skin, your brain, your bone marrow, all of those are regulated by clues from the outside. You don't have a stem cell just deciding on its own that it's going to start dividing or not. It's got to be tightly regulated. And so that, for sure, I think has to be the same case with myeloma. And I think that the two pieces of evidence why I would think that that's the case is that if you, what we found is that if you treat patients, let's say you treat them with something like lenalidomide, the stem cell, and you get rid of plasma cells, the stem cell number actually starts going up. And it's going up because your body thinks that your plasma cells and your B cells are, you know, an organ, right? So if you get rid of the mature cells, then the immature cells say, look, you know, we need to make more mature cells. So the only way we can do that is by starting to expand. And so that's why there's, I think, a balance between or a communication between plasma cells and B cells in the normal situation, right? Because you only have a certain number of plasma cells in a normal person. You only have a certain amount of immunoglobulin in a person, and all that is super highly regulated. And I think most of that regulation is through the microenvironment. So in the case of myeloma stem cells, what we found is that we've looked at this, and there are a couple of factors that we found in the bone marrow. One of them is a factor that was originally studied by a group in France called Growth Differentiation Factor 15, or GDF15. It's a signaling molecule, and what you find is that what this French group found, which was amazing, was that if you take bone marrow, what are called bone marrow stromal cells, which are thought to be important in myeloma, if you take those from myeloma patients or normal patients and you compare them, the myeloma patient ones will make this signaling molecule, GDF15, where normal ones don't. And what they found was that the you can measure the amount of this protein in the blood, and if you had high amounts, that was associated with you relapsing faster and actually not living as long. So this group had tried for many, many years to figure out, well, what does it do to plasma cells? Because it's a myeloma thing. You know, we find it in myeloma patients, but they could never, ever really find anything of note. And so we had studied bone marrow stromal cells. We were interested in factors that might regulate stem cells. And if you have this property where the levels of this thing predict things like relapse and survival, to me, that is not a plasma cell thing. To me, that is a stem cell thing, right? Whether you relapse or not, it's a stem cell thing. So we looked and we found that this molecule, GDF15, actually had a profound effect on myeloma stem cells, where it had almost no effect on plasma cells. So I think this explained what the French group was seeing. And so I think that's an example of something that gets turned on when you have myeloma. And I think, a great example of how the environment actually is regulating what tumor stem cells are doing. And there have been sort of notable findings in things like leukemia and colon cancer and breast cancer that show very similar things, that the microenvironment changing is really a part of fueling what cancer stem cells might do in each of those diseases. So I think that the tumor microenvironment is super important, and I think that if you said, well, this is some abnormal thing, and maybe what we can do is target that, you know, for us, it doesn't really matter if they're plasma cells or B cells. GDF15 just seems to fuel cells growing faster and growing, you know, more profoundly. And so what we think is targeting GDF15 should impact regrowth of tumors no matter what the stem cell looks like. And so I think that's a great example of how the environment may play some role in the regulation of cancer stem cells.
several of us just came back from ASH, and typically I attend the presentations at our phase two and phase three trials for myeloma. Are there other people working on the myeloma stem cell? Were there ASH presentations, even if they were at the biological level?
I would say that the one notable study was the Penn group, I think, had really done a great job. Like, there was a high degree of skepticism. I think that their initial findings using CD19 CARs was very intriguing evidence that what we had been studying all along might have some relevance. And one of the studies that was presented was actually a CAR T-cell study where they combined a CAR T-cell against BCMA, which is primarily expressed by plasma cells, with a CAR against CD19. So they're trying to target both things. And, I thought that was, and they said they're doing that because they want to target myeloma stem cells. And so I thought that was actually a really clever approach. I think that there's some thoughts at Penn where Dr. June and another person, Al Garfall, are, and he was the person who reported the CD19 story with CAR T-cells originally from Penn. And so I think they have thoughts of doing a trial where they're doing combinations. And I think that is actually a great way to go. I think that you cover a lot of bases by doing that. And so I thought that it was not super easy to figure out what was going on in that trial that was presented. People were responding. You couldn't really tell why was it because of the CD19 or because of the BCMA. But we're doing studies now with the Penn group, with Dr. June's group, to try to figure out in individual patients, does targeting CD19 or targeting BCMA or actually targeting both actually, have a better therapeutic effect. And they're trying to couple that with a clinical trial where they're actually going to combine CARs against CD19 and BCMA.
For a given individual, the actionable mutations on a regular plasma myeloma cell are not necessarily the same as would be on their myeloma stem cells. Is that correct?
That is correct. So I think that, and there's this whole idea, and I think it makes some sense, because if you think about, there's been this ongoing sort of discovery of polyclonal disease. And what I mean by that is that let's say you have a mutation in RAS, which is pretty common, and it may not be that every single myeloma cell has that mutation, right? Some might, some might not. It may be that it's interesting because if you look at myeloma patients at diagnosis, it's about 10% of them you can find a RAS mutation. But in patients who have more advanced disease, it might be more than half of them, actually. And so if you go back and you look actually at those 90% of patients where you couldn't find a RAS mutation, if you look carefully enough, in most of those patients you can find it. So for each of these different clones, as they're called, that pops up, it's a stem cell that makes those things appear, right? And so I think that, there's a couple of interesting things from that. I think that one is that if you just go and you go and sequence the tumor, right, and the stem cells are 1/100,000th of the tumor, you are never going to pick up the mutation in that one cell, right? Because it's swamped out by the 999 cells, right? You're never going to be able to pick that up. And so I think that part of why you see a mutation sort of, quote-unquote, pop up, I think part of it is because the stem cell that's has that mutation is just resistant to the chemotherapy that's there. And that sort of explains why you see sort of different clones in an individual person. And so I think for us, what we're trying to do is figure out if we can find the stem cells in a person and we identify the mutations in those stem cells, can we actually predict what mutations are going to arise when patients relapse? And so we have a little bit of data suggesting that if you isolate the stem cells at the when someone gets diagnosed, or the B cells when someone gets diagnosed, they have different mutations than the plasma cells, the myeloma plasma cells. If you wait long enough and the patient relapses, oftentimes you can see those mutations in the relapse disease that we originally found in the myeloma stem cells. And so we're trying to figure out, can we use that as a tool to predict what mutations are going to arise? And if those are mutations that we can target, maybe what we should do is try to target them very, very early, instead of just waiting for the person to relapse. So that's one of the thoughts that we have about how to use stem cells to sort of inform how do we treat patients over a longer period of time.
Thank you very much, Dr. Back to you, Gary.
Okay, thank you, Jack. Cindy, your questions?
Okay. Hi, Dr. Masuri.
Hi.
This is a fascinating topic. I really think there's some, validity to the idea of a myeloma stem cell, but what we're talking about seems to be going a little bit over my head, so I don't know if my question makes sense, so I'm going to ask them anyway. Okay, so myeloma cells are plasma cells, and plasma cells come from B cells, so myeloma stem cells seem to be coming from B cells, from what I'm understanding.
Uh-huh.
So is there some type of test that we could do from your blood or your bone marrow that can track and count myeloma stem cells, or aren't we there yet, or can't we identify them yet?
Can you
speak to that?
Yes, so that is an awesome question, right? So you would think that if you if you were able to monitor them, right, and let's say that you were monitoring them during treatment and you're monitoring them after treatment, if you were to say that they were responsible for you relapsing, maybe they would start to increase the number before you relapsed, right? That might be a supposition.
Right.
So we actually have data that that's the case. So if we monitor people over time, what we can find is that if we see changes in the myeloma stem cells, and we don't know what causes them to start growing, but if we follow patients and we monitor them and we count it, and the way we count is we actually count them by using a test in the blood rather than having to do bone marrows. And if we follow patients over time, usually anywhere between 6 and 12 months, we can actually predict when someone is going to relapse. So one question is that, can we use that in a clinical way to, let's say, start treating patients earlier before they relapse? So we have some thoughts about doing that. And then the other thing is that can we use that test, right, since we can't use the M protein, we can't use the number of plasma cells, right, can we use that test, count the stem cells, as a way of figuring out if a therapy that we're giving, let's say like CD19 CARs or something targeting B cells, whether that actually is going to work in the person. And one way we could see is that, do the stem cells go down? Because like I said earlier, I don't think that you could sort of say, look, we targeted the stem cells, and then the next day the M protein is probably going to be exactly the same, right? So I think it's a way of monitoring the efficacy of things that we're trying to use to target stem cells in sort of a more real-time fashion. But as you were saying, we're trying to refine these tests, but like I said, I think that in most patients where we've done this, we've been able to predict when are people going to actually relapse before you see their M proteins change, before you see their light chains change. I think we can predict you know, at least a few months beforehand that that's going to happen.
And is that test just available in the Johns Hopkins laboratory, or is it available for other people to use?
So the way that we're doing it is we haven't been, you know, with clinical testing, you have to have tests be done a certain way, and they have to be done in a certain kind of lab, and they're called CLIA-approved labs. And so if you get, like, your M-protein checked, right, your M-protein
right.
gets checked, and it gets checked in a CLIA-approved lab, and what that does is that that means that a clinician like me can actually use those results to make some sort of decision. Do you need more treatment? Can you stop your treatment? Do we need to change treatment? Like, we can do that because we know that the value that we're getting has been, you know, qualified by being done technically in a certain with a certain level of scrutiny. In our case, you know, what we do is we do this test, we've developed this test, but we don't have it in a way that we can use it clinically. So right now what we're doing is primarily using it as a way of monitoring different clinical trials that we're doing, but we haven't ever used it as a way of it, in a normal clinical way where we would say, look, let's monitor your stem cells. If they're going up, we're going to start you on, you know, their tumab or CD19 or something, right? We would like to get there at some point, but right now the testing that we do is just in a regular plain old lab that's not a clinical lab. And so we can't use
okay.
that information to inform, you know, anyone what we should do. But like I said, what we're doing using it now is to try and use it as sort of a result to try to help us figure out whether we're on the right track or not when we do clinical trials where we attempt to target cancer stem cells.
Okay, that makes sense. So eventually you'll try to validate that tool if you find it as something that could help predict relapse.
I would love to do that because I think that it's better to try and, you know, prevent relapse from happening rather than waiting for it to happen and then try to get on top of it. It would be great if we could develop it into something where we can really monitor patients over time. And so we have some funding from the National Institutes of Health and the National Cancer Institute to do those types of studies to sort of validate our earlier findings. But it's a lot of work to do that, so we're trying to figure that out.
Okay, sounds good. And I know we've been talking a little bit about the CD19 as, I guess, one of the markers on the myeloma stem cells, and we did talk a little bit about UPenn's first CAR T-cell trial. I kind of remember that coming of age because I get treated at UPenn, so
uh-huh.
they were telling me about it a long before it, and the only drawback for me on that was that it had to be done with an autologous stem cell transplant, you know,
right.
so because I guess the rationale was CD19 is not really aimed at the myeloma cells because they're not all your myeloma cells, but a stem cell, like you were saying. So my question is, and I think that's what Dr. Cohen was telling us when he came to our support group in Philly about this idea. And I think he addressed this a little bit earlier, but is there a trial now going on that kind of gives, like, you know, myeloma the true punch? Like, at first you use something like BCMA or an autologous stem cell transplant or something to really get you in a stringent complete remission with hopefully MRD negativity, and then using, like, a CD19 antibody as a maintenance therapy to start killing, now that you got rid of all the myeloma cells, now let's try to kill off those stem cells that may help you with relapse.
So you should come and we should work together because that's exactly what we should do. And so
okay.
right now what we have is we have a trial. We had done a trial previously with an antibody against CD19 from a company called MedImmune. The antibody is called Medi-551. And we use that in patients where we had given them Revlimid and then we added the antibody to, and what we were measuring really was using our assays to see what happened to myeloma stem cells. And in that study, what we found is that patients initially, after they were diagnosed, got a combination of Revlimid and dexamethasone, and they got that for two rounds. And what we could see after two rounds is in just about all the patients, the number of myeloma stem cells started going up, even though their M proteins were going down. And then we gave them three doses of this antibody, and we could see those increasing numbers now starting to go down. And compared to other studies we had done before that, where we just gave people Revlimid and dexamethasone over a number of months, we never ever saw those numbers really decreasing. So we thought that the antibody had activity. We talked to the company for a long, long time about doing some sort of follow-up study. There was a lot of back and forth, and what we decided in the end to do was to do something that I think is also surprising to a lot of people. We decided to do allogeneic stem cell transplants, and after an allogeneic transplant, then give people this antibody against CD19 and give it to them for a year. So that trial actually just opened. We just enrolled, we've enrolled our second patient. And so what patients will do is, they, if patients have high-risk disease and they're been recently diagnosed, or if patients have relapsed or have refractory disease, we will do an allogeneic transplant in them. It's one of these mini transplants where you get cells from a donor. One thing we found in our studies of transplantation here at Hopkins is that the age of your donor matters a lot. So the younger the donor, the better the outcome. And that's for leukemia, lymphoma, myeloma, whatever. And so what we do is, the other thing we've done over the years is made it, developed strategies so that you could use half-matched instead of fully matched relatives. So if you are have a fully matched relative, then that person is almost always going to be a sibling. So if you're older, unfortunately, and you have myeloma, then it's likely that your sibling is going to be older as well. So if we use half-matched donors, basically all of your kids can donate for you. So if you take patients who are a little bit older and they have kids, those kids are typically younger. And so what we do is, we've been doing a lot of transplants where there are mini transplants. These are all done as an outpatient. You get chemotherapy, and then you get either blood stem cells or bone marrow stem cells from a child. And then following that transplant, our plan has been to, about 3 or 4 months after that transplant is completed, to start people on this antibody. So we have people now who are just now going through the transplant phase, and they're getting allogeneic transplants. We had looked back at our studies of allotransplant, because it's a controversial, very controversial thing, and we just published this about 3 months ago. And so what we found is that about, we had looked at about 40 patients, at 39 patients, all the way going back to 2003, from 2003 to 2011. And what we found in those patients were that about a quarter of them, a little more than a quarter of them, were still alive and didn't have any relapse, right? So the other, so it doesn't cure everyone, but there's a portion of people we think are cured. I think that the other is that one of the knocks against allogeneic transplantation is that it is really dangerous, right? And so the danger comes from this complication called graft versus host disease, where your donor's immune system starts to attack you. And the way that we do the transplants here at Hopkins, the risk of getting very bad graft versus host disease is pretty minimal. Like back in 20 years ago, when I was actually at in a resident in Seattle, and I trained at the Fred Hutch. We were doing allotransplants, and there about at least a half to two-thirds of individuals, patients, would get really bad graft-versus-host disease, bad enough that it could potentially kill them. And in the way that we've modified things over the years, in this group of patients from 2003 to 2011, the patients who got serious graft-versus-host disease was in the single digits. It was like around 4%. So we think we can make it. Yeah, so I think we can make it safer. The relapse is still the major problem. Most of the patients relapse. So that's why we think if we build in this thing to target the stem cells using CD19 after an allotransplant, our hopes are to prevent more, to try to reduce the relapse rate in more individuals. Because we think we can safely get them through the transplant. We think that it's very beneficial for people to have a new immune system. And we're trying to harness that by adding in this antibody to try to go after the stem cells. So that's a trial. Like I said, we just opened about a month ago, and we just enrolled our second patient.
Fantastic. Cindy, we need to move on. So if you don't mind, we'll go on to Jaelic.
Thank you, Gary.
Yes,
sir. Thank you, Dr. Matsui, for the discussion. You have answered two of my questions, which is the MEDI-551 used for the untreated myeloma patients and the allo transplant or the mini allo transplant. So I think my third question is related to something you discussed, which is the circulating cancer stem cells and how they correlate with either disease burden or showing relapse, or alternatively also showing response to treatment. Is that what is considered the basis for what we are calling liquid biopsy?
So I would say that it's not. I think that when people talk about liquid biopsies, it's more like they take your blood and then they do sequencing on it to look for mutations. Mm-hmm. So they might be able to tell you, oh, now you have a RAS mutation just by sampling your blood, because as the cancer cells die, they'll release their DNA and that'll go into your circulation, so they can find mutations in your blood. That you don't know whether it comes from stem cells or from mature cells. It's just DNA. They don't know where it comes from. But that is something that, you know, especially in solid tumors where it's difficult to re-biopsy patients, you can sort of see, well, what mutations are present in potentially in the tumor just by looking at someone's blood. So that's usually what a liquid biopsy sort of is thought to be. As a side note, it's an interesting thing where, like, there was a study just published here at Hopkins where people were doing liquid biopsies on patients with prostate cancers and looking for specific mutations. And what they found was is that if they took blood from an individual patient with prostate cancer, they sent the liquid biopsy test to one company, and then at the same time they sent it to a different company, you would get most of the time very different results, right? So the whole liquid biopsy thing, I think, is going to be great in the future, because then you don't have to go back and get more tumor. But I think that it's still in its infancy, and so there's like everything, there are kinks to work out. I think as far as us for circulating cells, what we find is that they oftentimes actually do the opposite of what you see with other parameters. And so if you treat someone with RVD, their plasma cells go down, but paradoxically their myeloma stem cells start to increase. And like I said, I think that the reason for this is because if you get rid of the mature cells, somehow the stem cells sense that and they want to start growing. It's just like if you burn your skin, right? Your skin has stem cells in it. If you burn your skin stem cells turn on right away so that it can repair your skin. If we give you high-dose chemotherapy and we put stem cells in you, those stem cells are going to grow right away because they need to make blood for you as quickly as possible. So I think it's the paradox between, you know, the stem cells want to maintain that compartment, all those mature cells. And if all those mature cells aren't there, then they start to freak out a little bit and say, look, we got to start making more cells. So I think that that's why we see what we see in patients who undergo therapy. It's almost like the opposite of what might one might expect. Like if you're making your M protein better, then you should be making your stem cells better as well. But in actuality, in most patients that we've looked at, it's been the exact opposite.
Gary, I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Alex. And if we could go on to some of the questions from the audience, it'd be good. Priya?
Thank you, Gary. Yes. We've just almost done with our time, but we have time. Probably take just one caller. Dina, you're alive. Please ask your question.
Hi, Priya. Thanks so much. Hi, Gary. Dr. Matsui, thanks so much for joining us tonight. I was listening and trying to follow, and I do find the science quite daunting. And So my questions may be very, very layperson-based, but I'm going to give it a shot. I was listening to a recent patient power video, and some of the panelists, one included Dr. Trico, and he mentioned that at diagnosis, you actually have a trillion myeloma cells. And you have about a billion or so left after treatment is given. So that, to me, is just a daunting quantification. And then now I'm adding in these myeloma stem cells that apparently don't respond to treatment. So it's very, very sobering to contemplate that if we haven't actually yet identified these extended growth cells responsible for the function of relapse, that we may likely not be able to cure myeloma. So I'm just trying to really understand, are myeloma stem cells actually dividing or rising at all times, or do they primarily do this under treatment pressure? So in other words, is standard of care treatment, including melphalan, clearing the playing field for them, in essence?
So I think that I think it probably depends from person to person. It might be a little bit different. I think normally in most systems, stem cells grow actually slower than the mature cells in terms of the rate at which they grow. I think that if you stimulate them, then they can grow very, very quickly. I think that, you know, it is a for sure, I think that in our hands, what you see is you see this relative increase in the number of stem cells over time as following treatment. That may level out over time, but I think that it's for sure we want to figure out what are the things that are actually stimulating those cells, because I think that that might be a way, rather than targeting CD19 or CD130, that may be a way of targeting some pathway that's important that we can do with, you know, a pill or something like that. I think that would be something we would like to do, because my guess is that you have to do something to target that population, not with just one foul swoop like a transplant, but you're going to need to do that over long periods of time. So we would like to find drugs that are very safe that you can give over long periods of time, and that would be one of the hopes. I think that one of the things is that, you know, what I for sure, you know, like to offer is that if people have questions, you know, just let me know. I'd be happy to talk with you. I'd be happy to answer emails. And I guess the one other thing I would say in terms of that is, you know, I've spent 20 years here at Johns Hopkins and loved every minute of it, but I'm actually moving to Austin, Texas, to take a job at a new cancer center, the Livestrong Cancer Center, that's at the University of Texas. So I'll do that in June, but I think I'll be pretty easy to get in touch with. And so if you have questions, please feel free to just reach out.
Will you be also working on this research in your new position?
I will. My job is a little bit different because there's no blood cancer program because the medical school is new and the cancer center is new, and so my job is to actually build a cancer, a blood cancer program. But as far as my research goes and as far as the patients that I'll see, it'll still primarily center around myeloma. I'll find other people to see leukemia patients and lymphoma patients. That's not what I do. I do myeloma, and so I'll find, you know, I think I'll be able to find great people to help me mm-hmm. take care of all blood cancer patients, but I would still, you know, I'm devoted to spending my time working on myeloma.
Well, I wish you well. Thank you so much. And
thank you.
Just my last question. I remember listening to Dr. Roger Tiedemann from Canada a couple of years ago, and he was explaining progenitor cells. Are those the same as myeloma stem cells? Is it just a different term?
They are exactly the same thing. I think Roger and I study exactly the same thing. I think Roger is a wonderful person. I think that their findings, his group's findings, actually mesh super well with our findings. And I think that on top of that, the work that was done at Penn using CD19 CAR T cells, I think, really buttresses. So I think we've been very fortunate that other really good groups have really recapitulated some of our ideas and brought light to some of our ideas, because I think that being alone and out there with a weird idea that nobody likes is not easy. But I think we've gotten great support as time has gone on.
Well, your theory makes perfect sense to me, because obviously there are cells that stay behind that are responsible for relapse, and seeing all of the treatments and the quadruplets and hitting it with the kitchen sink, if it's still not eradicating it, somebody's missing something. So I'm grateful to you and your ideas, because it may end up leading to the answers someday. So I wish you the best of luck, and thanks so much for taking my call.
Thanks. It means a lot.
Thank you, Dana.
And Dr. Mansouri,
you,
you're no longer a lone ranger. You have a whole posse.
That's nice. So,
thank
it's
you,
nice
Gary.
To not be alone. That's tough.
Thank you so much.
We are well over our time here today. Dr. Mansouri, thank you so very much for all the information that you've shared with us, and we wish you very well in your new position. And hope to get you back with us sometime soon then, maybe in the new year sometime, yeah. Gary, Jack, Cindy, and Yelak, as usual, thank you so much for your participation. You're the pillars of this program. And this talk will be made available on CureTalk's website. Please join us in the new year when we are talking to Anne Quinn Young of MMRF in January 25th, 2018, and please visit curetalks.com for details on upcoming talks. Thank you very much.